All right, thanks everyone for coming. On behalf of the Cornell ECE Department, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and the Engineering and Medicine and Biology Society, we're proud here to present Dr. Alvin Dewan, here to talk about advances in medical technologies and the future of engineering and medicine. Before we start, I just want to ask everyone to please keep your phones on silent or vibrate. The lecture is being recorded for future release. So Dr. Dewan currently is a distinguished professor of electrical and computer engineering at NJIT, as well as the dean of the Albert Dorman's Honors College. And he also serves as the executive director of the Interdisciplinary Design Studio there. He's also an adjunct professor of radiology at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey. He's published over 200 research articles and refereed journals, books, and conference proceedings, and his work has been funded by NIH, NSF, and other industries. He's recipient of a Martin Epstein Award, National Institutes of Health First Award, Sigma Chi Young Investigator Award, University of Cincinnati Faculty Achievement Award, and the prestigious IEEE Engineering and Medicine and Biology Early Career Achievement Award. He's also the conference chair of the IEEE 28th International Conference of Engineering and Medicine and Biology Society in New York in 2006. He's a fellow of the IEEE, a member of Sigma Chi and Eta Kappa Nu, and he's listed in the Who's Who in the World, Who's Who in America, Who's Who in Engineering, and Who's Who among America's teachers. So we're pleased to have quite a distinguished lecturer with us today. He was recently interviewed by TechEye on the top 5 medical advancement areas, and his article has actually received a record-breaking amount of hits. And to that end, we have invited him here today to talk further on the future of engineering and medicine. And without further delay, please help me in welcoming our lecturer, Dr. Dewan.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And one of the things that I need to talk with IEEE president that IEEE never serves dessert. So there's a pizza over there, but no dessert. So what I did that I picked up these 3 M&M, but they are only 3. So they are going to be given to the person who is going to ask either best question or answer the best way. So if you give the best answer or if you ask the best question, one of this is coming to you. Now, usually I'm known as the professor who throws candies as students, but this time, I mean, this is a pretty large room, so I don't think I have the arm to throw 100 feet. But I would keep that over here, and will encourage you to be interactive with me. It's a pretty open forum, and I would like to present some of the things. The one other thing that I should tell about myself that I'm known to fly over the slides. So I told Akshay that, I have pretty much my lecture worked out. And he said, okay. And I said, well, I have 100 slides. He said, that's too many. I said, all right. So I worked, pretty hard. And then I said, okay, I got 86. That's it. So let's see how far we go today. So my job over here is to walk you through the current status of the technology and also the advances in biomedical sciences. Now, these two used to be a pretty adverse areas. And I remember that when I was growing up in India and I came to the high school and they told me, either you take math or you take biology. And I said, why? Why I can't take both of them? And they said, no, either you are going to take biology and write entrance exam for getting into the medical school, or you are going to take mathematics and you would be writing the exam for Indian Institute of Technology or Engineering School. And that was pretty daunting to me. And I'm glad to see that in my lifetime, we have come to the point where engineering solution to biology and medicine has produced revolutionary results today. Today we walk into the diagnostic radiology and we see all these machines, MRI scanners, CT scanners, ultrasound and everything. And then we can clearly see the results of the mathematics and the engineering research applied into the medicine. I don't know how many of you know that who won the Nobel Prize for the CT scanner or X-ray computed tomography. Anybody here? No one? Okay, his name was Alan Cormack. And if I tell you that he was a mathematician, would you believe me? He received Nobel Prize for medicine, but he was a mathematician. He was in the Tufts University, and he happened to be the external advisor of my PhD dissertation. So I know more about him than many people know. So today I think that we are evolving the multi-scale computational biology as the result of the marriage of applied sciences and engineering and medicine. And that's the journey I will walk with you. But before I do that, I like to acknowledge the support and the participation and the contribution of my graduate students, because the professor doesn't do much. It's all the graduate students and undergraduate students who bring glory to professors. So these are 24 students of mine who graduated under my supervision, and I like to thank them. So first of all, the question that we are going to ask, how many of you think, what is it? Do you watch television? What is it? Criminal Minds? Okay, that's a good answer, but no candy for that.
Ask a question that sometimes drives me crazy. Am I or the others crazy?
And I found very intriguing. So the question that I asked, what is the most critical issue to you? Now that's a candy question. What is most critical question to you? What do you feel today? That what is most important in your life? No one? Yeah.
My family.
Very good answer. Okay. What else?
Who I'll be tomorrow.
Who I will be tomorrow. Yes, you want to look, what your future is. But both of these comes after a certain thing. Okay. Yeah, last.
My health.
Yes. Okay, there you go. Well, I will not throw that, so you can come and pick it up. Your life. Believe me or not, I'm not being selfish, and you would not be selfish if you tell that the most important thing in your life is your life. Because if your life is not there, if you are not alive, you don't have a family. You don't have a career. Okay? So the most important thing, the most important issue is to remain healthy. And believe me, if somebody has lost some beloved member in the family, or somebody is sick or handicapped, they know what I'm talking about. So sometimes we take the things granted, and then we realize its value when we lose them. But the smart people know the value. So if I'm talking about the life, I'm talking about the being healthy. So the question comes in there, that what tools I have to guarantee that I remain healthy, you remain healthy, the society remains healthy. So that's why we are going to find out the solutions to our medical problems. It's very clear, it's no brainer, that everybody is going to get sick, or everybody is going to get aged, and everybody is going to get dementia to a certain extent. I'm already started forgetting what was my father-in-law's name. Not that. Okay, so predicting future is a very challenging task, so you've got to have a crystal ball. But what is this crystal ball based on? Let's look into the past. We came from somewhere, I don't know, but Stone Age seems to be the right reference mark. And we came to the point where we talk today that this is a digital age. All of us look at the digital gadgets and everything. The one is over here, the iPhone 4S just was released yesterday. People getting crazy about it. So we can't wait for the technology to invade, even if it is our privacy, right? We will allowing them. But how much that technology is impacting our health or bringing the solution to our health. So the first question is, how did we do so far, right? Only then you can extrapolate into the future, because the future doesn't come out of the blue. You know, it comes, it has to be a basis there to predict future. So one of the things that if we look from the Stone Age to the Digital Age, it's pretty clear that we didn't do too bad in terms of life, living longer. So in the Stone Age or the Bronze Age, life expectancy at birth was around 26 years. They die pretty young, right? Today, the world statistics is 67.2. But in the developed countries, the average, I think in US, is about 87 or so. So it's a pretty remarkable curve. And I want you to look, even though if you are not engineer or mathematician, you can appreciate this particular growth, you know, in life expectancy. And of course, what it is correlated with is the gross domestic product. That means the people who live in prosperous society, they have better means to remain healthy than the people who struggle under the poverty line will have very hard time to stay healthy and live longer. But that's one thing around the globalization and other things, but that's, I'm not going to talk more about it, but I just want you to think about it. The other thing, which is the landmark, is what is the probability that at the time of the childbirth that that particular child will live? Okay, so infant mortality, that's another very important landmark. And we see the exponential decay over there as well. And certainly, the what this graph shows, that even though the world does follow the same trend, in the developed countries, it's much better than the developing economies. Okay, so from 2000 till date, or 2011, what's the most important thing that has happened to the world economy? Globalization. That has impacted almost everything. Because of the global connectivity, we have the technology and information exchanges throughout the world. The transportation is not a barrier. So even though we can talk about the employment and other issues, but what it is that today we are so concerned about the global connectivity, and we know that it is going to impact us, not only on the economic basis, but also on the life basis, that a virus outbreak in China, within 24 hours, the people in New York are getting, oh gosh, what's going on over there? And how do we get ourselves immune from there? See, this has never happened in 18th century or 19th century, right? So today, it's not that the stock exchange that is going down in Korea is going to affect the market and the stock exchange on Wall Street, but it's also a little virus or a rat that has started the problem in somewhere, you know, around the eastern part of the globe is going to affect the western part of the globe. So we need to work around. We need to have information. We need to have the things like weather prediction, even though I think the weather predictors are pretty bad. that wherever they say it's going to be the rain, most of the time it's the sunshine and so on. But even though we have a systematic evaluation of the prediction and the environmental changes in with respect to the weather, but we don't have that with respect to health monitoring. Ever thought about it? That if we have all these databases and the understanding from genome to physiome, which I'm going to talk a little bit about today, we actually could provide the outbreaks of epidemics. Sometime it is going to happen. And that will allow us to make sure that we are not caught in any epidemic in the future. But let's see how that is going to work. But the global concern today, certainly the health is on the top, the environment, energy, and the sustainability, and you guys are over here pretty much on the top of it. But the one thing that we ask ourselves, okay, if we are trying to find the technological solution to remain healthy Do we have sufficient knowledge? Do we have sufficient understanding to guarantee that, yeah, if we are going to get problem, there is going to be the right solution for us? Well, that's what we are going to understand. So before we talk about the technology, let's think about the system biology. Because basically what we are trying to remain healthy is from the cellular level to the organ level and the physiological behavior level, we wanted to understand that we have a knowledge base to work on. Okay, so if we start looking into that, what do we know about the system biology, we actually don't have to go very far. It's all pretty recent. And the first of all, everything is started, and I think you know Darwin's theory of evolution. It is interesting to see that it was not until 19th century that somebody started thinking, okay, how did we evolve? How do we exist? Right? So in 1865, Gregor Mendel discovered the first pair of genes, which is the very basic fundamental block of life. Right? But it wasn't discovered until 1865, until late 19th century. So it's pretty recent that we started thinking about the system biology. 1910-11, Thomas Morgan discovered the gene's role in the evolution of life. Then 1944, Barbara, they received the Nobel Prize in 1983. That's just about less than 30 years ago. Okay, discovered that you could have a chromosome structure of the DNA. And the DNA, well, actually, DNA was not discovered even at that particular time, but they started thinking about it. But the chromosome can jump from one gene to another gene, talking about that evolution of the life and its differences in the life form. That started the understanding of the genetic disorder, which is very, very important. And in a few minutes, I will demonstrate that why this is so important today to actually connect the genome to physiome. Okay, 1953, James Watson and Francis Crick, they started looking into the DNA molecule. And that was the first time they actually started synthesizing the basic building block or the blueprint of life, DNA. Okay, continued, 1966, Marshall, Henrich, and Severo started looking into the genetic code, that how one gene affects the evolution. And the proteomics started, the protein. And it's very interesting that that particular structure of only 20 amino acids could provide 64 combination, but those can further be looked upon with the DNA sequencing. So Paul Burke, and it was very interesting that Paul Burke, when he started working on to E. coli bacteria, and he started looking into that if he could do the recombinant DNA sequence. He did a preliminary experiment and it went crazy. It was the cells all over, the bacteria growing so fast that he got scared. He stopped that particular experiment for about 7 years and then came back and started doing that particular thing again and eventually won the Nobel Prize in 1980. And recombinant DNA molecule, that became the very big foundation stone of what is called today genetic engineering. 1974 continued, 1980 until 2003, or not actually 1990 to 2003, when the Human Genome Project was established. And actually that project is stopped 2 years before the projected date. So they completed the database. And today, the whole evolutionary theory and the process of the genetic engineering predicting whether you are at higher risk than other person to have breast cancer or skin cancer or heart attack or any particular type of the critical diseases from your blueprint of the life, it is possible today. It is also possible today to see the environmental effect on the DNA sequences. So the thing that started in late 1880s, and particularly picked up in early 1910 or so, and from 1910 to 2010, just within 100 years, we created so much of information about the genetic sequences and the genetic information that today we are just trying to figure it out that how that correlates to the life, to expectancy of life, to the risk factor related to the life, so that we could do some prevention. We could figure it out that how a particular gene environmental correlation in a country like South Africa is actually going to affect the population down the road across the globe. Because we are so connected now. It's not, you know, the 17th or 16th century where we don't care where the nation X is doing. We have to care because eventually it is going to turn around and come to us. Okay, so that was one thing. A very quick overview of what happened in the last 100 years. Now let's look into the electronics and instrumentation. So, second candy question, what's Moore's Law? Do I have it here? No. Okay. What is Moore's Law? Yes.
Computing power basically doubles every 6 months.
6 months, wrong. Every 2 years. Okay. I can throw at you. Ah, that's good. All right. So he actually started in the original paper every 12 months, every 18 months, and then later on adjusted for about every 2 years. Okay, interesting thing. Has anybody visited any museum of electronics where they saw the vacuum tube, the radio with the big knobs and everything, right? They used to work on actually 120 volts or 230 volts and big, you know, tubes over there. And after that, at Bell Lab, the transistor was invented. And after that, the semiconductor technology started putting these transistor switches, like the on-off thing, into very, very thin nanometers range layers. And that's what you have, the technology, in your laptop processor or in your cell phone processors or the iPhone 4S that came yesterday. So the question is how this technology evolved. And it actually very amazing that the technological advances and the power of the computer and the storage and also the price tag that followed pretty much Moore's Law from about early 1900 to till date. But I'm going to show you that that is coming at the end of the road now. No more Moore's Law is possible. But before we do that, we wanted to think about that the calculations per second per $1,000. That means that this is one of the landmarks. If you pay for $1,000, how many calculations per second you do, which is in computer engineering is called MIPS, million instructions per second. And if you think about that from the age group of the 1910 to 2010, it has gone up pretty much following the Moore's Law. Interesting thing, you can find what you played when you were 5 years or 6 years old in one of these gadgets. I played on actually somewhere here. But if you look into the transistor's count, how many of these basic elements of the transistor are in that particular processor, which is the heart of that computing machine. So somewhere, how many of you have dual core Pentium processor in your laptop, right? So you know that? That's somewhere here, dual core Pentium. You know how many transistors are in there? About 2 billion. That little chip that you can hold on your fingertips had 2 billion transistor elements over there. That's pretty amazing. Now, we're coming to that particular technology where each particular transistor, PN junction or PNP or NPN technology or whatever the basic format is, the one particular junction is just a few atoms wide. So after that, the leakage current and other, and I'm not going to give you the technology lessons over here, but it's coming to the question mark over there that the further increase in the density is not possible. So the Moore's law has to come to the stop. Or we find some other way of computing, which is a challenge for you, right? Find a new platform of the computing. So what that computing does to us, what that technology does to us. So from 1900 to somewhere 2020, while we are around about somewhere here, and if you think about what we have been playing around, you know, this power PCs and towers and all those things, and a power Mac over here, which is about 1,000 plus, you know, MIPS that $1,000 can buy. What kind of computation gives us intelligence? That means an intelligent decision-making process that we take it granted so far that, okay, well, you look good, so I have to say hello to you. Just simple, this particular part of it, right, is a smart thing, right? Because I'm not going to say that to everybody. Right? But even if this particular intelligence, we cannot create from the machine today, right? So forget about understanding the system biology. So we have the intelligence which is, believe it or not, around or less than a spider in a machine, not in me, in a machine, okay? So if we extrapolate this particular curve further and say if I would be able to create a machine that will have equivalent intelligence as of one human being, and if Moore's law continued in the technology development, it could be possible beyond 2020 to think about all those scientific fictions of Terminators, you know, coming to life. So extending that particular thing, we are somewhere here, and this is the intelligence of an insect brain, you know, somewhere here. But if we continue doing that, and one human brain intelligence would come somewhere around 2020. And if you think about that, Moore's law will still continue to provide a better and better technology that could become the source of providing intelligence, all human brains together 2060. So it's not going to happen in my lifetime, but in your lifetime, those kind of scientific, you know, fiction theories where the machine took over the rest of the world, you know, it could happen, but all right. So one of the things which is important to not only project where the technology is going, but more important thing is the acceleration, what we could do from that particular technology, okay? So this particular thing is almost the same thing that I had shown you before, but the important thing is over here. Between the Industrial Revolution and Agricultural Revolution, it took about 8,000 years. Okay? Between moon landing and the light bulb invention, it took about 90 years. But if you continue that, the next landmark that came into the technology development was Internet, World Wide Web. It took 22 years. But between the World Wide Web invention and Human Genome Project, it took only 9 years. Okay? That's what technology is enabling you to address those problems in an accelerated manner. So I don't know what would be the next landmark from the Human Genome Project to the next one, but I can bet one area for which I'm the editor-in-chief for the IEEE Transaction on Biomedical Engineering Letters, and I'm bringing the issue, actually, it just came out yesterday. If you look into your IEEE database, Explorer, You will see the TBME letter of special issue on multi-scale modeling and analysis in computational biology and medicine. I think that is the next plateau, but you know, I could be wrong. All right, so what that particular technology has enabled us in order to analyze the system biology fundamental block, which is the DNA, is this, that the DNA sequencing analysis today to correlate the patient's history, patient response, gene environmental risk factors of certain diseases. This is just the start. Could be done in a very cost-effective way, in a manner. It is, you know, less than, just about a few cents today that you actually have to pay in terms of doing DNA sequence analysis. Okay, so now we got a little bit of idea about the growth in the system biology understanding. We got a little bit idea about how the technology advanced. In fact, the acceleration in the technology advances is so critical with the Moore's law that if the automobile industries has followed that for the fuel efficiencies of the car, what would you guess? That one tank full of the car, how many miles it will go? If it would have followed from 1970 till date the same kind of fuel efficiency growth as you saw in the computational power in terms of the MIPS? I'll give you the answer. Would be, yeah. Pretty much so. Yes. So all that you had to do, buy the car, take it out from the dealers with full tank, you will never have to fill that tank again in your life. See, that is the power of Moore's law, which we experienced in technology growth. So that power, if it is utilized to understand the system biology, to find answers to the behaviors of the organs and the pathology with respect to the fundamental blocks of the life, from genome to physiome, and I'm going to define the physiome in a few minutes, then we might have the tools to understand what we should do in terms of the therapeutic intervention without damaging the physiological structures. And I will explain that a little bit more as we move on. So today, when we go, we see the technology impact in medicine. It has revolutionized diagnostic radiology, CT, MRI, SPECT, nuclear medicine. This all is a result of the teamwork and the collaborative synergy from mathematical sciences to physics to chemistry, biochemistry, engineering, instrumentation, all solutions applied towards solving the problem in medicine to find out what's wrong with us when we don't feel well. It has enabled genetic engineering. So the basic genetic code, we have been able to find the correlations with that. We have been able to replicate DNA sequences, enable the treatment and therapeutic intervention through computerized analysis and computer-aided diagnosis. Is leading to the future trend, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. It has helped the pharmaceutical drug development because we cannot always spend hundreds of millions of dollars to actually produce Viagra or anything else. What we need to do is create the experimentation that actually can be simulated on a scale in a cost-effective way with respect to the genomic models and the models of the cell to see what should be the effect of the pharmaceutical drugs. It has enabled a minimal invasive surgery, and I will show you some of the examples of that. And it has provided us the electronic healthcare records information database along with the genomic database so that we can understand that what is the correlation from the genes to the environmental studies in terms of the outbreak of the critical diseases. Okay, so in order to find that particular correlation, we need to understand a little bit about, which probably all of you have read in high school biology, but you might have forgotten, so I'm just going to go very quickly into this, that human body is a very complex mechanism, and it has a multiple scales of the representations from the submolecular structures to the organs and then the behavioral level, and we are going to look a little bit more into that. And so all of those systems create subsystems like a nervous system or digestive system or respiratory system or circulatory system to make us live, right? So everything in the body, from the subcellular level to the organ level, is trying to do only one thing, which was the most important thing, stay alive. Everything else after that, whether you are good to your girlfriend or boyfriend or not, everything comes after that. But first you got to stay healthy. Okay? And that's what your body is trying to do. Every mechanism in your body, every subsystem in your body is trying, working very hard for you to stay alive. How is that doing? Just think about 300 billion neurons. We were talking about the 2 billion transistors, which were the building block of a microprocessor, central processing unit in your computer. Here we are talking about a neural cell, 300 billion neurons in your body. They are trying to create a systematic pathways of the signal transduction and the processing, so that if you think about it, oh, I'm feeling thirsty, I need to just have a sip of Coke over there. Could you imagine how many millions of synaptic junctions, activities, and action potentials have just enabled to do that, which we take so granted? Okay, so that particular flow of the information is a very basic thought process in the middle of the cortices, and just, you know, involving the substructure of the cortical regions down to the neuromuscular junctions, and saying, pick this particular glass up, open your mouth, have a sip, and digest it. Millions of the sequences are involved right in there. So we're working into enormous complex architecture, connectivity, and density, which goes into the dimensions of 10 to the power of 20 to 10 to the power of 23. But we don't do that at 3.6 gigahertz frequency. Now, anything within this particular synaptic activity with the action potential is hardly a few milliseconds. That's how slow we are as a human being. But interesting thing is that even though the action potential will last from 2 to 5 milliseconds, that as fast as it can go, but we know how to hit 160 miles per hour baseball. Okay, we know that, right? So the answer to a very basic question, whether we have to have a faster and more density of the technology processor to solve the problem and to have the intelligent behavior? Not so. Because we don't do that. I don't have the action potential with the speed of 3.6 gigahertz in my brain. I still work, and you still work, from 2 to 5 milliseconds. But the answer to that particular question is over here, the dimensionality. Just think about an ocean, right? Every water molecule in that particular ocean is a very slow movement when a tidal wave comes in there, right? It can't be in a pentoseconds or anything. That particular vibration is hardly in a millisecond, right? When it is, but when the tide comes, collectively, it makes a disaster. That's what it is. So if there are 10 to the power of 25 or so water molecules, even though if those water molecules are deviating from their mean position in a very slow, in a millisecond manner, but together they create a state space, and that state space has a resolution which is much, much higher for you to make the decision. That's how you see that the baseball coming at 100 plus miles an hour, and you make that particular decision that how to create your reflexes so that Derek Jeter can hit a home run. And you say, wow. Okay, so we are slow compared to computers, but it's stochastic in nature. What we try to put on the computer is more deterministic in nature. But what we try to do ourselves is more stochastic. So decision is based for the system biology on the optimization of the likelihood, and as I said, survive and succeed whatever you're trying to do. If you're trying to hit that particular baseball, you want to succeed that. So you learn the behavior to move collectively the state space in the dimension of 10 to the power of 23 so that you can do the right action with your neuromuscular pathways. Okay, so all is that is done by the central processing unit of the system biology, which is called vascular brain, right? So our CPU, Pentium, is right there, okay? And what does it do? It's about the vascularity of that is amazing. 100,000 miles of blood vessels in the brain. You can circle the earth four times with the length of the vascular structure in the brain. It's 2% of the mass of the body, but consumes 15% cardiac output and consumes 20% oxygen. Pretty remarkable thing. Okay, so what is the basis of the physiome? I think that we talked about genome, and now I'm going to introduce the basis of the physiome in over here. It's a subcellular structure, tissue, organ, and subsystem, and they all work together. As a form of they working together, the physiological processes, the behavior of the human body is determined. That means today, well, I'm not feeling so well, or gloomy, or I'm angry. It all depends on the interactive processes from the subcellular level to the physiology. So it's not a myth, or it's not a coincidence that somebody's is calmer than the other person in the general behavior responses, because again, you know, the blueprint is coming somewhere from the DNA sequences. You could modify the behavior, but some of that is actually hardwired physiologically. Okay, so what do we do here? We have these kind of technology over there. Like we could do the full body imaging with the MRI, functional MRI, DTI, SPECT, ultrasound, optical reflectance imaging, you know, lots of imaging or the signal processing technique. So what we are trying to do is, instead of opening up the body and saying what's wrong with our physiological organs, we are just trying to find non-invasively through the electrodes or electrical engineering instrumentation in the sensor that as much as information we can find, and then we can connect it together so that we can figure it out that what's normal signature and what is deviation from the normal. So the signals and the images. Okay, so one of the things that we need in order to understand the physiological processes and its behavior so that we can define the pathology and treat the pathology is kind of what I call M3 integration paradigm. The first thing, it has to be multi-scale. That means, you know, at the nanometer scale with the subcellular processes, but at the centimeter scales, you know, the organs. So every particular label that I talked in the earlier view graph has a different scale, different type of the signal that we can capture. Okay, it has to be multi-parameter because you have different kind of information. For example, when you go and somebody is going through the cardiac arrest or something, they are going to first put the ECG in there. That's the electrical signal that actually represents the electrical potential travel pathways through the left ventricle. But then they will put the person into the stress test to find out what is the cardiac volume. Then they will take the blood test to find out what the cellular molecules are telling you. You know? So all of this information is put together, and integrated in order to find out, okay, what is the diagnosis over here and what's the prognosis over here and what we are going to do in terms of the therapeutic intervention. All right, and it's multidimensional, of course. You know, some signals are one-dimensional, one two-dimensional, and if I want to understand the cardiac volume over the time, it's four-dimensional and so on. Okay, so in order to predict the future, you have to combine these two things together, right? All right, so I'm going to be putting the first trend, and this IUPS, International Union of Physiome Society, that is started by a scientist named Peter Hunter in Australia, University of Auckland. And that is basically telling you that you create the databases of the information from the genomic sequences, and then you try to figure it out from the, each of the hospitals over there, that what patient went through what kind of pathology and what was the treatment and what were those signals that we collected from there. And then try to take the ECG and the MRI images and the genomic sequence and try to see that whether we can create a model of the physiology from the subcellular level to the organ level to understand why this particular person behaved with respect to its myocardial infraction. And if we could do that, then we can figure it out with another models of the pharmaceutical drug that whether or not we can treat this particular patient. Today, if somebody gets a cancer and goes into the chemotherapy, you know what's the most critical problem is? Which drug is going to be responsive to that particular person during chemotherapy? And some of the cancers are so aggressive that you give them one chemotherapy drug and the patient does not respond, and by the time you switch over to the second one, your time window is gone. Patient is dead. One of the main revolutionary research, which one of my friend David Reschemeyer from MOTFIP is doing in Florida, is actually correlating the models from the genomic sequence to the responses to the chemotherapy drug. And this initial model says that if I have a cancer patient, I will do the DNA analysis and genomic sequence analysis. I will go into that particular model and pick up the right drug that I know has 90 percentile or better confidence that this patient will respond. So to treat it better. So my first trend over here is what is generally called biomedical and health informatics. The people thought that MP3, MP5, and all these, you know, telecommunication project has created this video streaming in a high resolution and a lot of data that our cell phones cannot handle. Forget about all that particular data, because the health informatics data of the future from genome to physiome project is going to be million times larger than the data set that we are dealing today. And the question is going to be, what is intelligence interpretation? How do we make intelligent models to treat ourselves better? The answer is in that information, but how do you mine that information? How do you extract that information and make mathematical models that correlates the system biology to treatment? Enormous question, okay? And that's the challenge for you, whether you are coming from physics, chemistry, you're coming from information sciences or computer sciences, this is the challenge. Okay. So the first thing is the redefining the healthcare procedures and the protocols based on modeling, simulation, and analysis of gigantic amount of the information that is coming in your way. Okay. How deal with that? And this is what is called leading to personalized medicine. That means I just don't want to treat you by having, you know, one of the five drugs and the way I pick up that particular drug. Today you have the infection. Whether you're going to be having amoxicillin or, you know, any penicillin or any other saline, you know, it is just my choice. I have no systematic way to tell you until you have 3 weeks of that antibiotics that you are going to respond to or not. No way. But is that the right way to treat it? The answer, you know. Okay, The other thing about the global healthcare concerns, so I'm actually, I have 10 more minutes for my 1 hour, right? So I'm going to finish that in that particular term. The other thing is that, is it the responsibility of the physician when you get sick? And I know that there is also the gender difference, right? Among women and men, who goes to the physician in time? Women. Men are pretty bad in getting to the physician's office until everything goes wrong with them. They just think that they are machos and they can fix things themselves. But that's not the case. Okay? So the question is that if personalized medicine is going to work, that means I need to find out, see, in a systematic way, what is the right drug for you on the onset of the disease, or even earlier than that, right? When there is a pathological progression, but it has not come to the level of the malignancy, for example. So pre-malignancy stages, if I can pick it up. How am I going to do that? There has to be certain monitoring. It is the same thing in the crime security basis, that if you want to pick up or if you want to avoid another 9/11, you have to put the monitoring thing right in the downtown areas and look into the activities over there. The same thing is, we have to monitor our cellular activities right well before we get into the pathology. So how are we going to do that? That has to be based on our own monitoring system, just like a diabetic patient today is monitoring the glucose level and then providing that information to the physician so that the physician can set the right dose of insulin or the other medicine over there. Isn't that the right model? The answer is yes. So that's why all of this lack of healthcare monitoring is actually taking us to the critical diseases at the point when it is too late. So we have to give up the way, the style. We have to, the other field that is going on into wearable sensors. That means all of us, if our genetic code is telling us that we are on a higher risk factor, wouldn't that be smart to wear some of the sensors and look into the physiological monitoring well before the advancement of the disease? Because the prevention is much better than the cure. So that is a global priority. And why? Because it's also very expensive to treat the patient. It's also very cost effective to put the prevention modes well before the onset of the disease. Just a simple thing. A skin cancer, malignant melanoma. If you get it into the clinical stage one, pre-metastasis, $150 excision process. You take that particular lesion out, wide area excision, followed by some, you know, antibiotics, the patient is disease-free. Melanoma goes to the clinical stage metastasis 5. The patient is hospitalized. The blood vessels becomes the carrier of the malignant cell. The patient hardly can live 16 weeks at the most. And the cost, up to $160,000 per day. So our society cannot bear that particular burden of high healthcare cost when they are not needed. And the effect of the environmental pollution is also over there. So this is what I call point of care technologies. That means you need to know today, or your generations need to know, that how people are going with respect to their vital signs or the behavior in South Africa or China or India or in Korea or in US, before you think about that there is a pattern emerging, just like a tsunami is about to come, an epidemic can also be predicted. But we need to have the information. We need to have all the monitoring in place. So I think that one of the things that is going to be done over here in order to provide high quality healthcare in a cost effective way is that we have to have some kind of monitoring for ourselves. in terms of the regular healthcare monitoring. Once in a year, going to the physician's office and having the blood test done is not going to do it. Okay, so there is something like this that the physician, the patient, this is one of the projects of the students that are doing with me, is this little thing over here is connected with your your smartphone or iPhone, and it's bloodless glucose meter. It's a spectroscopic technique over there that continuously is monitoring the glucose level in the blood. So those people who are chronic diabetic patient, they should have that, and the data is being recorded over there continuously. Anytime there is a trend with respect to the model, this cell phone is smart enough to give a call to the physician and say, okay, I want to make an appointment for this particular patient. And it tells you to go to the doctor. Okay, so this is the trend two, the point of care healthcare technology, redefining the healthcare services, that how you should be treated and when you should be treated. Okay, and that's how the health insurances and everything is going to be working. We need to provide the diagnosis and the healthcare, primary healthcare facilities to the people in the remote areas, in rural areas, in underprivileged conditions. It's no longer saying, like, you pay today the car insurance or automobile insurance for those who are uninsured, right? Don't you? Why do you pay that? Because you want to be safer on the road, right? The same thing is applicable over here. You want to make sure that those people who do not have the primary health care in underprivileged countries must be given health care. Not because that you are doing any charity, it's because you want to stop any outbreak of any epidemic. This is going to turn around because of the global connectivity and right happened to be in New York. Okay? So it's that phenomena which is going to happen more and more. And here are the enabling technologies and how you could see that. Okay, one of the thing is important, and I think that this is not very high. Anybody have seen this show? Bionic Man? Raise the hand. No? Just imagine, if you could run 65 miles an hour, you have solved the auto industry energy problem, right? We don't need cars. But how does that correlate today? I have a very, very good respect for scientific fiction writers because I think they are preeminent scientists because they envisioned the technology way before. But today, what happens is, and I wanted to show you this.
For nearly a month, 27-year-old your Alan Petrus Yellow was the Bionic Man science fiction writers have long envisioned.
See how that was quoted?
Using only his mind to control the bionic animal hand connected to his nervous system. I had a car accident in 2006 caused by a drunk driver. My car turned upside down and I lost my left hand and forearm. My father was devastated and began searching online for projects that could help me. That pioneering project turned out to be at Rome's Campus Biomedico, a university and hospital developing a bionic hand in collaboration with St. Anna School in Pisa, Italy. After passing several tests, the Brazilian Petrus Yellow was enrolled in the Life Hand Project. Four miniature electrodes were surgically implanted in what remained of his left arm. These electrodes helped
itself was not implanted, only connected through electrodes.
I needed a lot of electrical stimulation. Like the majority of amputees, I still perceive my lost hand. As they stimulated my arm with needles, I closed my eyes and tried to think that my hand did exist. You don't have your hand. You don't have your forearm. So how can you control the hand's movements? It's difficult to explain. I closed my eyes and repeated to myself, your hand does exist. It's there. It's in place. At a mental level, it's very stressing. I needed to concentrate. I needed silence. Then I said to myself, you can wiggle the fingers. You can pinch. You can clench a fist. You can open your hand. You can just do that.
So, this is revolutionary, that if you can have the artificial hand or limb controlled by the biological thought process. But as I said, that, you know, picking this particular glass and all those things was more than a million sequences of the signals that happened just in a few seconds. It's not that easy to do. It's a very, very big challenge to electrical engineering people, real-time embedded control systems. But if it could be done, we have a gateway, we have an interface to the neural system of the body. And if we could do that, it will create a very new revolutionary field of neural rehabilitation. All those people who are bound by the epileptic seizures or strokes, you know, every 40 seconds somebody in the United States is getting a stroke. And many of them are left with no neurological control to some part of the body. And this is what is going to help us in order to provide the neural rehabilitation in a totally new manner by having the neural stimulation through the electrical interfaces. So the bio-nanosensors, bioelectronics, and neural prosthesis, that is the next trend. One of the things is, and I'm just going to take a couple of more minutes, and it's probably done. Again, the scientific fiction. So this I'm sure that everybody has seen, Star Trek, right? And Dr. McCoy has a gadget something like this in order to do the diagnostic study. There it is. There, there's this thing. And he's giving his diagnosis. So today, when you go to an MRI, you have a little problem, you have a cardiac chest pain, you go to this stress test, and if you are going for the cardiac stress test, it's going to take you 4 to 5 hours in that particular hospital. And this guy is just doing shh, and is telling you left ventricle enlargement, this thing, that thing, and there. But even though it is far-fetched scientific fiction, so was the flying in the Stone Age. Who thought in the Stone Age that you would be exploring the space and going to the Mars? Nobody could believe that. So the people who don't believe on the technology today, but you are the movers. You are the leaders of the future technology. You could make it happen. So, and it will. So the thing is that why I'm saying that, because I myself was inspired by this and I created this little device which is called Nevoscope and is also known as DermLite. It took me 15 years to invent that particular technology and brought into the clinical diagnosis stage and brought it to dermatologists where now it is being used for early detection of the cancer. And it is being marketed by TransLite and 3Gen. So what it does that it actually creates the early diagnosis of the malignant melanoma that I was talking about. And it was just inspired by the same optical technology in there. So it could happen. So what I'm trying to tell you is just going back into this and showing you something else to set the trend of it.
Traditional white light illumination, it is not easy to tell where the tumor begins.
muscle tissue weakens. However, with the use of our fluorescently labeled biological probe, the tumor is now pseudocolored bright.
So, one of these things, why are they important? Because they are molecular tag imaging. So that means that if I have to have a surgical procedure to have my cancer or malignant tissue removed, I know that one particular cell remained in the body is going to reoccur the cancer in there. And one of the most critical problem in the surgical therapy is leaving behind that one particular cell. But how a surgeon can find out? While he's opening, the tissue is deforming and there is a blood pool out over there. How do you know that which cancer cell you left behind? This is the molecular imaging tagging technology, which actually creates the photofluorescence so that the malignant cells are discriminated from the normal cells, and that's what this particular field is. So the optical and molecular imaging technologies for patient monitoring, for physiological discriminations of the cells, and provide a real-time therapeutical intervention or surgical intervention. That's my fourth area. And the last, but not the least, isn't that amazing? Would you let a robot do surgery to you? Maybe not today. Maybe you have some, skepticism about it. But this is what is going to happen. Nobody can do a better laser eye surgery than a robot, not a human being. But it's going to change the entire way the surgical operation theater is organized today. I hope that 20 years later, when people are going to go into the medical school and they will see the surgical theaters, and then they will see a photograph of how the operation theaters looked like 20 years ago, that would be exactly the same thing how you look into the PS2 games, and not PS2, what was that? Atari. Remember those little things with the Atari computers to play the video games in there? Or you look into the technology, which was like 3.25-inch floppy disk to put it into the computer and says, this is cranking in there with 640, kilobytes of information, right? So. But it is going to happen. But the cultural change that is going to revolutionize, that guess what? How many of you are play video games with your controllers? You see that? You can become a surgeon. Because tomorrow's surgeon, as it was said over there, is not going to be leaning on the patient, because that's where the robot is going to be. What he has to do is control the controller. So, here is the area 5, surgical robotics, and I'm bringing the next special issue of TBME in 2012, so watch for it, and the surgical robotics. Redefining the minimal invasive surgery with the precision and excision accuracy that is sub-millimeter accuracy. In the real time, again, embedded controllers, enabling technology, and information fusion will allow that. So a lot of from computer science to mathematical models to instrumentation to engineering will change the future of the medicine. So I stop over here. I've given you the five areas. We'll take further questions. I still have one left. Yeah.
Two questions. Where do you see adult-induced quote unquote stem cells going? In terms of tissue engineering, and do you see 3D printing as playing a role in that?
Okay. All right. The first question. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Well, you had to share that with her. Okay. The stem cells for the tissue regeneration and tissue engineering, that is actually the sixth area on my chart in the top 10. So that's why I sent you that candy. That's exactly is one of the things. But in order to understand the process of the evolution of the stem cell therapy towards the reproduction of the tissue with respect to its biological properties, we need to have those correlation models understood. That's why it is sixth. Because if the trend, if the first one, the correlating and the models between the genome to the physiome level, if those multi-scale interactive models are not well understood, then we will be just throwing stones in the dark for tissue engineering. Because one of the problem is that you cannot afford, in the scientific fiction, this bionic man or the Terminator goes wild and kills the human race. You don't want that. Right? So when you generate the tissue, you wanted to make sure that you have full control on the biological properties of that particular tissue. Otherwise, it's going to create more problems for the rest of the body. Right? So that's why it is number six, but it is all correlated with the number one, over there. Your second thing was the 3D printing. I don't know that answer. Because my son is an architect, the elder son, and he's using 3D printing for the architectural material and the design. But I don't think that even in the near future, we have, until this particular number six succeeds in a revolutionary way, that we can actually fabricate a part of the organ in a sense that we can biologically induced or a stem cell induced organ controlled development. Until that particular happens, probably the 3D printing or those are enablers. But first thing is model behavior and the knowledge base. Okay? Any other question? All right, then thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed it.